better than transparent glass, because melting sand into glass was a difficult technique, and transparent glasses only became a thing in something like 1200 or 1300. The early optical glasses were made out of gems, which were easier to find to be transparent than cheap glass. So there's a long history of glass making. The Italians kind of perfected it on so many different levels during the Renaissance age, and continued to make very aesthetically pleasing glass objects. Glass blowing is also a real fun thing to watch. If you have nothing better to do, you know, turn your YouTube to glass blowing and take a look at some artisans' magic that they do.
We might need some a description of terahertz of radiation for some people to understand it properly. It's a submillimeter radiation, sometimes known as T-rays, T-waves, T-light, T-lux, or T-terahertz, THZ. It is a frequency from 0.3 to 3 terahertz, and in range from 1 millimeter to 1 of 100, or 0.01 millimeter. Now, because glass, before that, terahertz radiation is strongly absorbed by gases in atmosphere, and in air is attenuated to zero within a few meters. So it is not practical for terrestrial radio communication. Let me drop. Okay. So, usually the thickness of the glass is 1 to 2 millimeters, and we're dealing with two boundaries. One is the inner and one is the outer of the glass. And then if we have reflection and refraction, that will happen to those waves, even though they are able to pass the first boundary. And that's why it is attenuated. Terahertz frequencies are mostly attenuated by the glass. Now, as far as the paper, when I ask, now if we have visible infrared and terahertz, we know that paper definitely doesn't allow visible light to go through. You may have some if it's thin one. The infrared doesn't go through. But then the question is, what do you think, Dr. Roy? Is terahertz frequency going through the paper?
Yes.
And you're absolutely right. Now, cardboard. So we know visible is not going through, infrared is not going through. How about terahertz?
I think less of it goes through than with the paper.
It is absolutely correct. Foam. We have a foam, and then we have visible infrared. So visible doesn't go through. Infrared definitely doesn't go through. Terahertz.
Was that a question?
That is correct. Foam. Does terahertz goes through foam?
Yes, it goes through foam.
Yes, of course. And bandage. Visible doesn't go, infrared doesn't go. That's why we wear the wind bandage when we have a wound. And terahertz, Dr. Roy.
Yes, it goes through.
Okay. So that's the end of the quiz. Everything is correct. Glass is a little bit different. It contains silica, quartz. But that's not the major story. The major story is the two boundaries and the refraction and the reflection. Although, at Brewster angle, if we have a certain porosity, then we would have a glass acting as a one boundary for the no reflection, no refraction. Oh, actually, there was a one nice video I sent you, that video a long time ago. There was glue called stopping the glucose flowing through the hole from the bucket down to another bucket. Do you recall that?
No, unfortunately, Wesley, I do not.
Yeah, because that leads to our fiber optics. At first was, imagine that you have a bucket on the table and the bucket has a hole. The hole is clogged so that the glucose inside cannot flow out. And then from the other side there is another hole that is shooting straight to the hole from the other side of the bucket, and you put laser into it. So the laser is going through the entire glucose that is in the bucket. Now you opening up the hole from the other side and letting the glucose flow down. And the glucose is flowing down to another bucket. Now what you can see is that the laser beam shooting through that hole, shooting to the string of flowing down in curve, glucose is trapped. And it's in the internal reflection that is taking place over there. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Okay.
So, on that principle, there was another video that I have shown you that was a lecture about the interfaces. And that could be seen that if you have two dielectrics but that have a different dielectric properties, or you have one conductor and the other one is dielectric, then the two-dimensional space between two of them is creating the interface for a very high frequency waves to go into, and for that there is a required Bresser angle. The effect is similar to that one explained by me with glucose, that the wave becomes trapped in that space, two-dimensional space, this between the dielectric and the conductor. But instead of dielectric being a physical slab, we may have a dielectric as the air. And then air is acting as the dielectric, and the slab, conductive slab, or dielectric with another properties is being used as a bottom of the interface. And then the wave at the Bresser angle is entering that that interface and is being trapped in it. Some of the strips in microwave frequency were actually using that technique. Also, some of the Dr. Roy, N2XJ.
I'm not quite sure if there was a question in there or an answer. I don't know.
Oh, I recall some of the directional couplers inside of the coupler. Have you ever taken out the directional coupler, Dr. Roy?
No, I have never disassembled a directional coupler yet. Yes, Jim.
Roy, have you ever considered that what we're dealing with here is intentional interference?
Yes, I often do, but there's not much I could do about it.
Fair enough. Just wanted to throw a thought there like I tend to do.
Yeah, I mean, usually the best defense is apathy. People want to get a rise out of you. They want to upset you. I know one unfortunate gentleman after repeater control operator turned his repeater off, went direct to the output transmitting frequency and berated this other guy for the next half hours. Probably the most fun that jammer had.
I've just been hearing stuff for a while. You know, I'm a newcomer, but patterns show themselves.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally there is a crosstalk. There are propagation conditions where repeaters operating on the same frequency kind of bleed through. I've had that happen to me in Brooklyn with the repeaters in Pennsylvania. Usually it doesn't get far enough to bother people in Long Island. But, you know, there are malicious and non-malicious causes for such things.
Roger.
Okay. So, just ending the subject. We have, if you go higher than infrared, we have an area that people are very much scared about it, which is ultraviolet. And X-ray and gamma, and then we have alpha, beta, gamma, and neutron radiation. Interesting thing in it is that although ultraviolet is pulling and pushing this the part not the particles cells. I forgot the medical term for it. X-ray is breaking the boundaries of between the cells. The gamma radiation is doing it the same, but actually much stronger, and that depends from how strong is gamma radiation and time of exposure, and that is measured in electron volts or kiloelectron volts or megaelectron volts. As far as beta and alpha particles can go only 1 or 2 centimeters up, and they are very easily stopped by the skin of the human being. Beta particles are a little bit more potent. I have one video showing beta particles in life. That's one of my devices that I have there. In real life, although we don't see the real beta particles, but we see the violent action of this beta particles visualization in triethylamine vapor. I'm not sure if Dr. Roy, you remember that. If not, then I can send you that part. I have an entire device that is you're putting very weak beta particle emitter, which would be one from the smoke detector. And you could see a very, very violent nature of beta particle. But beta particles are easily stopped by paper or plastic. Then we have a neutron. That's really nothing. Neutron radiation could be done at home. The neutron generator could be done at home very easily. It's nasty, but it's not as dangerous for the people who know how to deal with it. It is, again, an exposure. Neutron could go a few feet to several feet from the emitter, but also is the intensity of that exposure. If you have anything to add to it, Dr. Roy, I would appreciate that, and to actually.
AC2GS, okay, let's see. Alpha particles are basically helium-4 nuclei, two protons, two neutrons. They are massive, but they are positively charged, and electrostatic repulsion limits how far they can go through solid objects. That's alpha. Beta are simply high-velocity free electrons. They're negatively charged. They have very, very low mass. Next is gamma radiation, which is electromagnetic waves. As far as electromagnetic waves are concerned, ultraviolet electromagnetic waves and anything with a shorter frequency are all ionizing radiation. They do break electron bonds, and so they disrupt molecules all the way from ultraviolet on up. On Earth, X-rays and gamma rays are not based upon frequency ranges, but on the method of eliciting them. Whether you're accelerating an electron and banging it against something provokes what we call X-rays on Earth, and other forms of high-energy electromagnetic waves are called gamma rays. In cosmetology, it's different because astronomy can't really get a good sense of what's causing what, so it kind of defers to different bandwidth being X-rays and others being gamma. Neutrons are unstable. They have free neutrons last for about 15 minutes. They are very massive, relatively speaking. They are electronically neutral, and so the electromagnetic fields of solids do not slow them down, so they can cause a lot of trouble. So that's nuclear radiation in a thumbnail. Yes?
Just a point of contention. I wonder if most chemists would call UV ionizing.
Well, I think UVC is. You know, you might want to split hairs. Why? You don't consider it ionizing?
I mean, you can make free radicals, but I don't think that, at least from the chemistry classes that I've taken, I think the ionizing radiation is considered radiation which will actually knock an electron off and make an ion, as opposed to UV, which will actually split a bond and give you a free radical.
Okay, yeah, I agree with you. But in the scheme of things, it causes the free radicals cause pretty much the same problems that complete ionization causes. Would you agree with that, at least?
Absolutely. You're quite right. And you know, once we talk about IR, it's just a matter of spectroscopy done in the IR and UV. But yes, I do agree that the free radicals do end up generating, you know, teratogens and carcinogens, etc.
Okay, so we're ultimately in agreement. I have to fine-tune my use of the English language, and it's just that, unfortunately, so many people are confused about the general concept that they think that all kind of radiation is dangerous for you, all the way down to probably 60 cycles that's radiating from their utility outlets.
Yeah, it is laughable, a lot of the myths that are out there and the misunderstandings. And I'm glad you clarify it for us in a very easy-to-understand language. AC2PL, back to NET.
Yeah, so, Wesley, did we cover this subject for you?
A few more things. Beryllium. Beryllium is part grayish, very fragile, and very much dangerous when swallowed. But beryllium has many uses, and in electronics we can see beryllium very much often. It is a large scattering. When we were talking about reflection, refraction, but we weren't touching the scattering, the cross-section for high-energy neutrons, about 6 barns. For the energy, approximately about 10 kilo electron volts. It works as a neutron reflector, a neutron moderator. So if you have a source, mostly the source could be alpha particles, you have a beryllium window, you can actually make a beryllium neutron generator. Not more about it because I don't want to say too much. Now, as far as ionizing radiation, I understand it by subatomic particles or electromagnetic waves that have sufficient energy to ionize atoms or molecules by detaching electrons from them. And the particles generally travel at a speed that is greater than 1% of that of light, and the electromagnetic waves are on the high energy portion of that electromagnetic spectrum. The way that I picture alpha particles, having much experience with them, they are very heavy, very much heavy. And something that we spoke about, but we never finished, we were talking about unhappy atoms. There were isotopes and isobars, and I didn't cover that, and then I'm going to wrap it up. So, starting from isobars, there are elements which differ in chemical property. Although, you got to understand, I didn't come from chemistry. I was a bad student in chemistry, but I came from particle physics. So isobar is that element which differs in the chemical property but has the same physical property. Right. Yeah. Full mouth. So we can say that isobars are those elements which have different atomic number but the same mass number, and their chemical property, I might be wrong in it, but I think not. Their chemical property is different because there is a difference in number of electrons. It has the same atomic mass but different atomic number. That is because the additional number of neutrons compensate the difference in the number of nucleons. Now, as far as isotopes, if I took the example of the two things which have the same color, same physical appearance, such that you could distinguish between those two, but when you measure the weight of those two things, then you find that they are different. You relate the concept of isotopes with this example. So the atoms are made from electrons, protons, and neutrons, and nucleus is made up of protons and neutrons, and the electrons revolve around nucleus. So the atomic mass is the sum of protons and the number of neutrons, and the atomic number is equal to the number of protons. So in an element, that the number of protons is always the same, but the number of neutrons keep changing. We're dealing with isotopes. And to XJS. Yeah.
Okay, Wesley, like I said before, the way that I was taught way back when I was getting my bachelor's in chemistry was that all atoms were isotopes. Isotopes are simply the same element with a different number of neutrons, so they have a different atomic weight. So we weren't taught that something that, you know, only existed as one form was not a isotope. An isotope was just a way of describing differing atoms that were the same fundamental characteristic but a different atomic weight because they carried a different number of neutrons. Also, isobars, I don't think was mentioned once in my entire 4 years in college. It's not something that really came up as far as I can recollect.
I suppose I should distinguish some difference between the isotopes and the isobars. So if we're dealing with isobars, we're dealing with chemical elements which have the same mass. In contrast, the isotopes, different atomic structure of the same element. Then with isobars, the atomic masses are equal. With isotopes, the atomic masses are different. So isobars, atomic masses are equal, but isotopes, the atomic masses are different. With isobars, the physical properties are similar. With isotopes, usually the physical properties are different. With isobars, the atomic numbers are different. But with isotopes, atomic numbers are the same. And with isobars, chemical elements are different. But with isotopes, same chemical elements, but in different forms. In other words, when I was talking about unhappy atom and what is radiation, why is this radiation happen? Because you nature likes balance. If there is a atom that is not in balance, is unhappy, it wants to throw out that what it doesn't want, and then evolve to another form. And another form would never be the one that is coming from. That would be the another species. That would be another atom of something else. So hydrogen 1 has a mass number 1. Hydrogen 2 is deuterium, mass number 2. And hydrogen 3 is tritium, mass number 3. Now, those are isotopes of hydrogen. But we may have a completely happy atom, that's, let's say, gold. But then gold has its own isotopes, too. So the radiation only happens from those unhappy atoms. And there's actually the addition of that, what I said the last week, intuition.
Okay, Wesley, I don't want to go deep in the grass about chemistry. I really don't. I don't think people deserve that. Just as an overview, basically all of the characteristics that are seen by chemists are based on the electron valence shell of each atom. The thing that determines how many electrons are in the shells of atoms is the number of protons in the nucleus. Since the atom has to be neutral. So that determines all the elemental characteristics of a given atom. Neutrons are there to simply stabilize the protons that are in close proximity, trying to be held together by gluons, a strong nuclear force. And there's a certain optimum number of neutrons where the binding energy is the best, and occasionally you get extra or less neutrons, which destabilize everything and cause a risk of radioactive decay on a probability type of situation. Isobars, again, not really used that much as far as I know in chemistry. They could be quite different in characteristic because all that they have is the same atomic weight. If they have a different electron distribution, they could be very different. If you go from chlorine to fluorine, chlorine to the noble gas, that's one extra electron, makes a big difference. You go from a highly reactive material that's poisonous to some noxious thing that just floats by and doesn't interact.
Thank you for that. From the point of view of physicists, we have much easier to get to the subject. Isotopes, atoms that have an equal number of protons but different number of neutrons and protons are called isotopes. If I was to give some example of isotopes, that would be vanadium, carbon, calcium, potassium. There are stable isotopes. The unstable isotopes emit rays that would be alpha, beta, gamma. And those are emitted by unstable isotopes. Although here is a point, because somebody would say rays we usually understand by rays is electromagnetic radiation, and alpha and beta is not electromagnetic radiation, it's a particle radiation. Now, as far as the isobars, atoms which have the same mass number but different number of protons are called isobars. Easy. And to XGN.
Yes, it's easy, but as I mentioned, practically in chemistry, as far as I'm aware, it's inconsequential. It's just a definition. But Wesley, it's already 10:05. Rocco, KD2UAH, signed in and had a question. I hope he's still around. I hope he still has a question. So maybe we should table this for tonight, and I'll try and see if Rocco still listens.
Okay, I agree.
Okay, Rocco, KD2UAH, I hope you're still out there, and hope you still have a question.
Hey, Roy. I think I'm going to pass, and I'm going to hold on until next week, because actually I'm going to get to bed with this new time change. It's a little weird. I feel like it's 11-something already. So I'll say 7-3s and back to the net.
Okay, Rocco, pleasant dreams. I'm sorry it took this long. I can never figure out how long questions and answers are going to take with this net. Let me just throw out once again, David, KG2RY, because you also signed in early, just in case you're by the radio and you have a question. Okay, I think the jump ahead an hour has kind of tired out people listening to the technical net. If there's anyone with any other questions on any subject, maybe even amateur radio, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
US2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm still trying to figure out the name of the company that we're using the antenna for, the new antenna. I found something that looked like it, so I think I got the name of the company, but I'm not sure yet.
Paul, excuse me, Roy, KD2FI, you calling?
Yes, George, one second. Paul, I've been looking for the same information because my other club is looking for a better antenna, and we're considering the one that's working for Limark. I think I found it. I'm not sure if it's the same one. It's a folded quad dipole. I think it's made in India. I'm not quite sure if it's the same manufacturer.
Yeah, it looks like a company, Telwave. If you look that up, I wouldn't be surprised if that's it. I mean, it looks exactly like that, you know, when I searched through the different antennas. It's a four folded dipole. So, you know, you have basically four elements. Each one is folded. You could rearrange them. They rearrange them in 90-degree offsets. So this way, you know, you wind up with omnidirectional. That's what I've seen, but I can't confirm it yet. But it's working great. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, they certainly do make that product. So it might have been the one that Limark bought. I've asked a few people involved in the repeater technical crew to find out the details for me. But yeah, the way I've seen it in illustrations, they're four folded dipole loop-like radiators, and they're usually put in all four quadrants. You know, one's put one direction, the next one's rotated 90 degrees, the following one is another 90 degrees, and the last one is another 90 degrees. So they have all four quadrants with a folded dipole.
Yeah, if you go to Limark's homepage, they have a picture of it, and it looks just like that. But, yeah, I'm just curious about the company. I think it's a great antenna. Okay, your club might use the same one. Good to know. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I have no complaints. I mean, like I said before, in the good old days, I used 18 watts to get into this repeater, and then unfortunately, I had to throw 150 watts, and now I'm back at around 15 watts, and I assume I'm full quieting because no one's been complaining.
Oh yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it's great. So, yeah, and I could use half power on it instead of 55. On, you know, even with the original antenna, you know, before that one failed, I used to have to go 55. This one I could go half. So it's really doing great. From what I understand, they might eventually up the power a little bit more as time goes by, too. That would be great. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, that would be nice. And in addition, I think they're going to be reinstating the voter systems that Eric had scattered around the metropolitan area, so that should help as well. So my thanks to the technical crew that maintains the repeater and the executive board that directs them. I love the new antenna. I love the idea of not using my amplifier for these technical nets. George, you wanted to say something? George, if you're still out there, I got the idea you wanted to say something. Oh, well. Any questions or comments before we finish up this little portion of the Limark technical mess?
WS2N, one more comment about your website.
Sure, Paul.
On the top of the list, you have the story about Pfizer's pill. Are you a big fan of that? Have you read through that yet? Wonder what your opinion is to fight COVID. And I'm wondering how many pills you got to take. Is this one of these deals where you're going to have to take like 20 or 30 pills? You know, I know you take it like after 5 days or something. That's what I heard on CNN. But it looks like a bunch of pills after that. I'm not sure. Back to you.
Well, you know, it's an additional weapon in the armory. It does not take the place of something much more effective like vaccination. It does decrease the risk of hospitalization and death by over 50%, but vaccinating decreases your risk significantly more. So although I think it's a great benefit and we could use all the tools that we could find, you know, it's better than nothing, but I would still say if people had the choice, it is much safer and smarter to get yourself vaccinated than wait until you have to start taking magic pills.
Okay, and another comment I heard on the news was this will be great for, you know, sending it out to different countries, especially undeveloped countries. The idea is to, you know, I don't know if they could do it, but eradicate it, well, the best they can worldwide. And this would be the way to go. It's easier, I guess, to send millions of pills all over and then even have countries making their own pills. You know, they're going to do away with the patent and, you know, they'll have countries all over the world be able to set up factories and supply their own people.
Well, you know, one of the major strengths for this treatment choice is that there's no need for strange storage. You don't have to keep it refrigerated at ridiculously low temperatures. So a distribution of vaccines is much more complicated than stable pills are. So that's the reason why they're thinking that this would be a boon for countries that don't really have a good infrastructure to refrigerate and distribute refrigerated vials of vaccine.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. That's true. Yeah, there's only so much refrigeration you're going to get in these countries that barely have electricity. Okay. Very good. I don't know if FIU is back, but I'll stand by.
Okay, very good. I just want to remind people before we finish up tonight's segment that if you have any questions or comments or topics or puzzles or you want to contact me, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, Paul's is the spacenetreport@gmail.com. My link page is roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you a link to all kinds of interesting articles. And I stream Glen Oaks repeater. Just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com. And I always want to remind people of my KC2NJI's wonderful archive of technical nets from this club. It goes back to September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. He's had over 1 million visitors, and there's a lot of good information recorded in the voice of great amateur radio operators who have unfortunately become silent keys. So I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. It was another unusual series of discussions. I do hope that we get a chance to talk about amateur radio type of stuff in addition to all of the other stuff that we talk about, but we'll see what the future holds. I'll be back around 11 o'clock or so, but until then, here's Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, yeah. Okay, well, amateur radio-wise, the crew that's supposed to be going up, there's four astronauts going up very shortly, and they all are amateur radio operators. They all have call letters, which is great, which means that when they're up there for the next 6 months, they'll be able to hopefully make many contacts with schools and Boy Scouts and camps, and, you know, camps in the summertime and all of that. That's, you know, I think the ARRL is up to, you know, over 1,000 contacts since ham radio has been on the International Space Station. So that will be good. But, yeah, talk about that launch. SpaceX has launched a series of manned spacecraft since last May. They started off with Behnken and Doug Hurley. At that time, just two people going to the space station. They stayed for, you know, a month and a half, 2 months, and then they returned. And then since then, they've sent two more spacecrafts to the International Space Station. Each one with a crew of four. And now they're scheduled to send another crew up there. There was another flight of a crew of four, but that had nothing to do with the International Space Station or NASA, for that matter. They sent four people that were not astronauts on a three-day flight. And because it's all autonomous, they were able to do that. But that had nothing to do with NASA. Taxpayers didn't pay for that one. So hopefully this other one gets off the ground. It was supposed to launch Halloween, but they had weather problems, weather concerns, and eventually one of the astronauts, they haven't said which one, had some kind of a minor medical problem, which was delaying things. So now they're scheduled to take off on, I believe it's the 10th of this month, you know, a couple days from now. What's today? The 7th? So a few days from now, they'll be taking off. I think it's a 9 o'clock, around a 9 p.m. Launch watch on TV. I wrote it down here somewhere. 9:03 on Wednesday. So that's great. They were supposed to go up. There's seven people on board the space station now, and that would have added four more to make 11 temporarily, and within another week or so, that the other crew, which is still, you know, they have their spacecraft still attached to the space station, would deorbit because of the delays and the way, you know, that now the other crew's been up there for 6 months. They're coming up to the 200-day mark. NASA has, you know, contracts with SpaceX and eventually with Boeing with their Starliner craft to last 210 days. But when they hit 200 days, in this case it's going to be 199 days, they plan on deorbiting that spacecraft one way or the other. They don't like to go any longer than that because, say, there's a weather problem or a slight technical problem. They don't like to go over the guaranteed time that SpaceX lets NASA know that their spacecraft can fly and stay attached to the space station, which is 210 days. That was the deal. And they're going to get up to 199 days. So they're going to leave first. They're going to leave, I think, tomorrow, let's see, today's the 7th, yeah, tomorrow's the 8th. They'll be leaving tomorrow and then deorbiting and coming back and landing. They haven't decided if they're, well, they haven't released to the public whether or not they're going to land in the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic Ocean yet. You know, that one time that they, actually the first crew, when Bob Hurley and Behnken went up, Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken. When they went up, they came back and landed in the Gulf of Mexico. And the word went out that they were going to go there, and there were pleasure boats floating all over the place, getting closer and closer to this. And the, you know, the average guy in a boat don't realize, you know, we're not supposed to get too close to a landing spacecraft of this type. When SpaceX's crew goes out to secure it, when it first lands, they're very careful. They have they approach it from the right direction because you know whichever the wind is blowing. You have hydrazine rockets, 18 of them on these Dragons. So some of them could still possibly be venting, and hydrazine is a carcinogenic. So you know they're not going to announce where they're going to land. They don't want to give a heads up to a bunch of boaters in Florida to go out and go sightseeing when this thing comes down. But I remember seeing that. There were like dozens of boats you could see that were nearby. And they haven't let that happen since the crew that went up, not to the space station, the one that was amateur astronauts, they landed in the Atlantic Ocean. The other ones have landed in the Gulf of Mexico. And they have recovery ships on both sides, so they have that choice. And when they deorbit from the space station, you know, they'll hold at a certain distance from the space station. But at a certain point, they'll start to deorbit. Whenever they light their engines, that, you know, that will determine on where they will land. They know exactly where they're going to be going at that point. So, okay, that'll be great. We'll have three astronauts will be coming down because one of the four that's coming down is not an astronaut, but four will be going up. And if you take the average of the now 600 people that will have flown in space after this mission, the average astronauts that have gone up in space is around 50%. So that's pretty good. And it's increasing as the years go on. So that should be pretty good. Any comments or questions? WS1. Okay, the Hubble Space Telescope, which we talk about, you know, week to week or year to year here, has apparently shut down. I don't know if they got it back on yet, but as of a week or so ago, they had some more problems with the computers on board. Different corrupted data going back and forth. Once that starts happening, the CPU on the Hubble shuts everything down. They'll actually close the aperture door this way in case it starts to, you know, change its attitude. They wouldn't want that to be facing the sun at any time. So until they figure it out and work out the problem, they go into what they call the safe mode. Now, this has happened a couple of times this year already. One time, I think, they lost almost a couple of months out of it, out of the use of Hubble. But it's getting older. The last time it was serviced was 2009. I remember back then they said, oh, we'll hope to get another 7 years out of it. And now it's 2021. You're looking at, you know, years flying by. Yeah, over 11 years now. since the last service mission. Before that, there were, you know, a total of 5 service missions that went to Hubble. And since then, the shuttle has been canceled in 2011, so no more flights up to Hubble. The last one was touch and go. They were going to stop at 4 because number 5, in between 4 and 5, they had the Columbia disaster in 2003, and they said, that's it, we're not never sending another spacecraft on a journey without going to the space station. They want the ability to go to the space station. They would need the ability to photograph the entire shuttle, make sure no tiles are blown off that's going to cause a problem like what happened to STS-107, which was the Columbia disaster. So, you know, I mean, even that mission, they call it STS-125. In 2009, that made that final service mission. They were so worried that, you know, that there might be a problem. They wanted to have a rescue vehicle ready. So they actually had Endeavour on another launch pad. We have two launch pads at the time that had the capability of launching space shuttles. You had Launch Complex 39A, Launch Complex 39B. So on B, they set up another one, and you know, they actually had, before the launch, they actually had, you know, showed two pictures of two shuttles they were actually ready to go. So in case there was a problem, they were going to have a rescue mission go up, and that would have, flown to the Hubble and rescued the crew in case there was a problem. They would have just sent up two on the mission. I think they had 5, so they would have came back with 7, which they have that capability. So, interesting. Hopefully, Hubble gets back to work. They believe they can extend Hubble's use all the way out to the end of this decade, which would really be something. You know, that 2009 mission was, you know, I mean, they did a lot of upgrades, computers and batteries and gyroscopes and more modern gyroscopes, which last longer. The earlier ones tend to fail. So if you could have Hubble working, and now the James Webb Space Telescope, which is going up in December 18th, after 20 years of considering that telescope is going up, it's finally going to be going up. After pouring, I guess, $10.5 billion into that project, we'll have another great telescope sitting in space. It will always be good to compare, you know, real-time pictures from Hubble to when they used the James Webb Space Telescope. That was always the one of the goals, to be able to do that. You know, I think they're going to be able to do it. Hopefully James Webb gets up there okay. After launch, after December 18th, you know, we're not going to see pictures for a long, long time. It's going to take a month for it to be set up to go all the way out to the Lagrange Point 2, L2. Once it's set up, then they have to calibrate everything. You know, once they do that, which is going to take a long time, it will go into a science operation. So it's going to launch mid-December. You're not going to have science operations until maybe June of 2022. 6-month calibration system. 1 month to get there, maybe another 4 or 5 months to check everything out. Any questions? I think I left enough time for Echo Link if they're out there. But I didn't hear anybody. Anyway, there's another piece of information that NASA released. They said that they are giving the first land that it's scheduled to land on the moon, unmanned, will land next year, probably mid to late 2022. It will be launched on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, and it will go to the south pole of the moon, right near Shackleton Crater, and have an exact location where they would like this thing to land. It's a vehicle that NASA is paying for. They've already paid Intuitive Company. Intuitive Machines is the name of the company that built Nova-C. Nova-C is the lander. Nova-C, it's a good-sized lander. It's maybe about, I think, 10 feet tall, around 7 feet diameter. It weighs over 4,000 pounds when it's put into orbit. It's got four legs, and once it lands at the South Pole, it's got a drilling machine attached to the side of it, which will be able to drill down around 3 or 4 feet into the surface of the moon. We'll be able to bring up samples and analyze it. That's going to be interesting. They're actually looking for frozen ice or water molecules under the surface, and that's the goal. So now the drill part will be stationary. They won't be able to drive around with that. We'll have to wait for future missions, maybe the Viper mission. That will be going up. That's another paid-for NASA project. It's got a large rover on it. But this one will have a very small rover attached to it. So that this one will be able to drive around and actually check out communications between... they want to be able to see how the cops... it's almost like a Wi-Fi setup. I'm sure it's going to work good, but they've got this small little rover attached to the Nova-C that will be able to drive a mile or two away and be able to transmit on different frequencies depending on what they need. And they want to be able to have the bandwidth. They've got to be able to do video. So hopefully... They'll check it out. They'll transmit to the lander, to Nova-C, and Nova-C will be transmitting back to Earth. Intuitive Machines that's building Nova-C has a contract for three of these landers. This will be the first one. And as time goes by, I don't know if that's the second mission, but definitely the third mission, they'll already have a satellite in orbit. Probably a halo orbit around the moon. This way they'll be able to transmit directly to that satellite and back to the moon, back to Earth from that location. So they'll experiment with that and see how that goes. And then that will be on a third one. And there's other landers that, for different companies that NASA has already paid, and they have planned landings for a couple of other companies too that will be doing the same thing. Firefly has a lander that they plan on landing. Blue Ghost, I think they call it. And then another company, Peregrine, they have a lander. But this will be the first one. And we'll follow them on the net and probably on TV. And certainly on the internet, definitely the NASA site and all the other space-related websites that you can go to. They have, the news really for today is that NASA's given this company a go-ahead to actually land in a certain exact spot right next to Shackleton Crater, which is on the south pole of the moon. Any questions, comments for this part of the net? This is WS. Okay. Another flight I'm looking forward to getting off the ground is by a company called Astra. I've talked about them here on the net before. They launch a rocket, and that's they call it Rocket Number 3, R3. You know, no fancy name or anything, but you know, they plan on launching this thing from Kodiak Island in the Pacific, Kodiak launch facility, and, you know, from Alaska. You know, they've tried a couple of times, and the last one got off the ground. It went sideways, you know, that was about a couple of months ago. It went sideways first, didn't crash, went sideways, back about 100 feet, 200 feet, and then started going straight up. And from the telemetry, they figured out what happened, you know, why that happened. One of the, they apparently there was a leak, and then when the engines ignited, the RP-1, they use kerosene ignited down by the launch pad, burnt through one of the electrical connections, therefore closing one of the four booster rockets. You know, they had four engines on the booster. One of them shut down, and the next thing you know, this thing was actually going horizontally up like about 100 feet or so. And then what happened is the guidance system took over, and it straightened everything out. The thing took off with three engines. You know, small rocket. It's not a big thing, like, you know, Falcon 9. So it took off, and I thought it was going to make it to orbit. I watched it live, and it got up pretty high, but didn't quite make it. So I started to lose control, and they detonated it. They have a termination system that you know, either automatically or ground control that, you know, like you push the button and blew it up. But, you know, it came close to making it to orbit now, and they believe this next launch, which should be coming up probably, I think, maybe next month, or maybe the end of this month. Anyway, another Astra rocket is set to take off from Alaska, and hopefully this one makes it to orbit. They have big plans, this company. Now, this is not a reusable rocket at this time. They make it very inexpensively. They use similar system to the Electron rocket. They have Rocket Lab uses. They spin up their turbos with electric motors and lithium-ion batteries or something like that to spin the turbos, which pushes the tremendous amount of fuel and propellant, which is liquid oxygen, into the chambers to make these rockets fly. And they believe that their cost is so low they can have these things not be reusable. And they plan on doing, looks like, not hundreds, but probably thousands of flights eventually. They plan on making their own satellites, broadband satellites, similar to what SpaceX is doing. And when I talk about thousands, they plan on launching 13,000 satellites, broadband satellites. They plan on developing themselves and eventually selling to for subscriptions for broadband. And they're not the only company, of course, doing it. Like I said, SpaceX has right now around 1,700 satellites already in orbit through their Starlink program. They plan on eventually launching maybe 30,000 to 40,000 satellites, you know, for Starlink. The Kuiper broadband system that Blue Origin is planning. They plan on launching, I wrote it down here, 3,236 satellites. Over 3,000 satellites Blue Origin. They plan on, they don't have their own rocket ready yet, when I say they, Blue Origin, so they plan on using ABL. ABL is another rocket company that has not made it to orbit yet, and they plan on launching early next year their first rockets. ABL is they're mass producing all this 3D stuff going on with them. So they, you know, there's so many of these companies, it's almost impossible to keep up with them. They now have a contract with Blue Origin to launch Kuiper broadband system that they plan on selling subscriptions to. You have another company that has already 218 satellites in space. They only need around 650. They don't plan on going as low as, you know, in orbit as the other companies. So they're a little higher. That means they'll be over the horizon, from horizon to horizon, for longer periods of time than the other satellites. So they don't need as many. So they can do it with just over 600 satellites. And, not to be outdone, China plans on doing the same thing. They plan on launching another 13,000 satellites themselves. They don't have any up there yet, from what I understand. But, you know, I added all these satellites up. You're looking at, you know, like 70,000 satellites just for broadband total, you know, all these companies do what they plan on doing. You know, I just can't imagine this 70,000 satellites flying around. And now poor NORAD has to keep track of all of them. I mean, they got their hands full now. It's like a million pieces, and I'm not kidding, a million pieces that are bigger than a large nut flying around in space. I think there's 100,000 pieces that are 4 inches long or bigger that NORAD keeps track of. You know, if anything gets near, for instance, an active satellite, you know, and crashes into it, you could be losing, you know, a couple of $1 billion satellite. God forbid the International Space Station. With a crew on that, or, you know, now SpaceX launching these crews nowhere, not even going to the space station. China up there with their own space station. Junk flying all over. Now possible 70,000 more satellites. Not good. Yeah, there's plans on capturing a lot of this stuff. Or at least we don't do what we used to do. All these satellites that are set up by international agreement, except for China, they cheated a little bit. The boosters the final booster that, you know, might be a two-stage or even a three-stage rocket, they have it where they have to be able to reignite. You know, all the boosters, the main, you know, first stage boosters that go up, they don't have to reignite. They usually separate, you know, maybe anywhere from 30 to 60 miles up. They'll separate and just, you know, come back to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere or crash into an ocean. But the final boosters, these second or third stage boosters, have to be able to reignite. And this way they slow themselves down and deorbit. So at least we don't have those boosters flying around anymore like we used to. Although China unfortunately did. And they had this, you know, 50 foot long, or I think it was longer than that, maybe 60 or 70 foot long stage that was flying haphazardly, that they had no idea where it was going to land. And you can't have any of that anymore. So I don't know, I guess China is jumping on board with their deorbit program. They say they now have a program where they're going to eventually start sending, you know, rockets up to eventually bring stuff back. There's a lot of planning in that. Japan has the same program. European Space Agency, and of course we in the United States have plans on doing that. We've already started refueling our type of satellites, or it's a satellite that they've done this twice now. Grumman has gone up and attached to satellites that are running out of fuel, attach themselves to it, and they can fly themselves to proper orbits, even in geosynchronous orbit now, 23,000 miles out. Anyway, any comments, questions? This is WS1. Nothing heard. Space station is being resupplied. Another Progress vehicle went up there a week and a half ago, and it successfully docked with the ZESA module. That's the rear end of the International Space Station, one of the Russian modules. ZESA is all the way in the back. And then as you work your way forward, then eventually you get to the United States modules and the European Space Agency modules in Japan. But the back end of it is Russia. You know, they have the ZESA module. That's where crews sleep, eat. That's where a lot of fuel is kept. That they have thrusters on board to push the space station forward if they need to get higher in orbit, which they always do. Every so often they need to do that. And then all your modules going forward, in front of that is the Zarya module. That's another big Russian module. And then in front of that, then you eventually connect to the Destiny modules, which is part of the United States modules. Eventually, you know, you'll go to Unity. They call it Unity. Then the Destiny, and in front of that, you have the Harmony module. You know, one right after the other. And if you start going off to the ports, the starboard side, there is a starboard side and port side to the space station. You all have the Quest modules. You have where they do the EVAs, on and on. You have Columbus module by European Space Agency. You have the Kaibo module by Japan. That's all the front end of it. Well, this Progress vehicle attached to the rear end, which is good because Russia has a new module coming, looking down from the ZESA module. They have the new Nyoka module. That's the one that fired its thrusters, unintentionally, and wound up spinning the whole space station, which is like spinning a 30-story building one and a half circles. They got that under control, and things starting to work, finally work out with that module. That's a large living module. There's another bathroom in there, there's another bunk, crew quarters, big science module. Now attached to that will be this new particle module. It's a docking module, which got six sides you can connect to. And that's going to be sent up by the end of this year as well by the Russians. That will attach to the bottom part of the Nyoka module. And the idea of that is, if Russia and the United States eventually decide that space station has been, and they want to start deorbiting the stuff. Russia does not want to deorbit their stuff. They want to be able to separate from the rest of the United States and European Space Agency, Japan and Canada, and they want to eventually start floating all by themselves with their own space station. And they plan on using Nyoka, the particle module going up, and eventually other modules that might be attached to that to create their own space station. Well, that's the latest update I have on all the all what's relatively new. without repeating myself from, you know, from other missions. I think we'll come to a grinding halt, and I'm going to pass this over to Roy. I didn't hear any comments or questions, nothing on Echo Link or anything there, Roy, so all quiet for now. Back to you. Before I do, usually we come on, I'll check into the ClubNet, which is always on tomorrow at 8:30 on these repeaters. You have the Club InfoNet that comes on, and followed by George FIU. You heard him this evening. He does the Swapper Chop, and that's followed by Newsline. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the TechNet and all that you do for the club. Frank is sitting quietly on Echo Link. I don't think he has a question tonight. So he's here and listening in. Also, I took a look at the Telewave. It doesn't quite look like the picture on LIMARC. I sent you a possible contender. It's an Indian model that kind of looks identical as far as that picture they took of our new antenna.
Oh, great. Thanks for that. Yeah. Okay. Can't get enough of looking at these antennas, but very good. I know it's doing great, but I'll definitely look at that. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. I hope we get many, many, many good years of functionality from it. We've had some unfortunate bad luck with other designs for antennas. So I thank again the technical crew of the repeater committee and the executive board of LIMARC. I also want to thank all of you out there for participating and for listening. This is almost reminiscent of the good old days when Dick would run the technical net to past midnight. I realize that in your biological clock, your brain's saying that it's 11:56, not 10:56. So I appreciate you staying with me, participating in this interesting series of discussions. We delved into the human mind and all kinds of fun stuff. I hope that you'll be able to join me again next Sunday night when we'll try and do it all over again. As always, I like to end these technical nets in a similar way that Dick, K2RIW, used to. He used to advise people to be kind to each other. I think that's good advice in general, but particularly good advice for the past few years. The pandemic is still among us, so please be safe, be smart, and we'll talk again next Sunday. This is AC2GS calling the end to this, the Eastern Standard Time edition of the LIMARC Technical Net, and I am clear.
Good night, Roy.
Yes, your B2BX cell here. Some noise keeps keying the repeaters, so that it wouldn't let Echo Link through.
I'm sorry to hear that, Frank. I didn't realize. Yeah, I know there's been some weird activity on the repeater tonight.
Somebody has to be reminded that Halloween is gone, so the ghost signal should be also. One thing, and I think everybody's too tired now, if it were important enough, I just would have chimed in on the chat. One thing kind of intriguing, though, maybe we'll talk about next week, is that on the ARRL report, the league mentioned that AMSAT has now decided to buy some of its satellites. I think they said it's FM satellites, commercial off the shelf. I didn't know you could go to Amazon or Gigaparts or something and buy a satellite. I don't know where they're buying it from. I didn't look it up, but that's kind of amusing. I didn't know you could go buy a CubeSat off the shelf now. Go ahead.
Well, we live in a capitalist society. If there's a demand, there's going to be people willing to sell you all kinds of interesting things. CubeSats are not really overly complicated, so I could understand where some entrepreneur could figure out how he could make a small profit in the deal.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit reminiscent of the early
nap
days
time
of
complete.
And computers, of course, were specialized items sold B2B, you know, and, you know, suddenly around 1980, it started becoming consumer items you could buy with your credit card, and I guess maybe small satellites or CubeSats, and I think there's maybe a smaller kind are they nanosats? You know, are reaching that point now where you can buy them off the shelf. At this point, obviously, you still need a couple of million bucks to launch them, but it looks like that may start changing in the next couple of years or so. Go ahead.
Well, you never know. I don't think anyone really has any economy of scale with jet propulsion. It's still an inherently rather expensive phenomena, so I'm a little bit more dubious that you'll have Joe Public setting up his CubeSat. There's still going to have to be some kind of umbrella organization that has some rather deep pockets, I would assume. Yeah, I mean, it's like all aspects of technology. If you wait long enough, the industry evolves to the point where entrepreneurs can sell a stable product that won't bankrupt them in maintaining it, through the warranty. Microwaves, up until, 10 years ago, you basically had to build your own. That's why guys like Dick, K2RAW, kind of coalesced around that aspect of the hobby, and they built their own. Now you call up Down East Microwave and order whatever you want.
Yeah, I guess similar phenomena. Well, you know, I don't know. The cost of satellite launching, I guess, if SpaceX eventually gets, Starship tired. I wanted to say Starfleet. The Starship to work, I guess at some point SpaceX may be able to stuff a couple of hundred of these on Starship and launch it. And when they get their Starship and their booster back, they give you back your deposit. Imagine all kinds of crazy things happening. I think the problem there, it's still going to be expensive because you're still only going to be so much capacity in the orbital shell, so to speak. There's only so much room to put these things up there. Anyway, it does agree. I know everyone wants to go to bed. BB2BXL.
Yeah, I, unfortunately, I'm one of the few remaining Elon Musk doubters. He's made way too many promises that he's never delivered on, and I unfortunately remember almost every one of those, so I don't know. Rocket propulsion is going to be expensive until or unless some brilliant guy comes up with a whole new technology. I can't see where you could make it that much cheaper. You require a certain amount of propellant to overcome our gravity well, and, energy density of chemicals are what they are. It's not like you could rig something up with a little bit of antimatter or something, and even if you could, the antimatter wouldn't be free either.
think that could work because I was Asimov said it couldn't work, and he was right about communication satellites. So, but apparently there were some problems with doing space elevators from a surface, not surprisingly, because of atmospheric drag and a bunch of other things. So it thought it would work on the Moon and Mars, but it may or may not eventually work from Earth. So that seems to be the only possible technology out there that might obsolete chemical rockets in the near future anyway. Go ahead.
Well, space elevators are interesting things. Material science can't provide anything that meets the needs for such a contraption. They'll talk about nanotubes, but nanotubes is going to be the miracle material for everything, supercharging batteries, all kinds of fun stuff. So right now, it's just a daydream. Asimov came up with all kinds. Talk about Asimov. I don't know if you saw Foundation. There was actually a space elevator featured in the first few episodes of Apple Plus's Foundation television show.
Yeah, I haven't watched it. Maybe I'll put on one or two episodes. I have Apple Plus for the moment, but may drop it because I'm not watching it enough, but I know there's some good stuff on there. I just subscribed to Curiosity Stream. Marcus House has a coupon code that prices it at $14.99, which, and the amount of content there looks pretty good for the cost. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I have such a glut of material to watch when and if I find the time that, I don't know, I can't bring myself to invest in another streaming service. If you're curious, you know, you could watch it, but, don't expect anything good. You really can't make that novel into a real television show. Isaac Asimov tended to write more about ideas than actions, and so they've kind of reset the show to actions. I think there's even a Death Star scene, so they've turned it into, unfortunately, a space opera.
Yeah, a friend of mine really likes The Expanse, and I think that's well done if you're into space operas. I haven't really gotten into that either. I think there are a bunch of these. My favorite space opera, so to speak, is Elon Musk, and like you said, it remains to be seen whether or not he can actually do anything to work. But he got the Falcon 9 to work and the Dragon capsule to work, and it's being used by NASA. And I'm wondering whether DOD is going to engage, try to compete with the Chinese on a hypersonic glide, because it seems like the only short-term way, perhaps, to compete with them. So yeah, he does a lot of stuff that doesn't work, but he's also done some stuff that works. Go ahead. Wait a minute, I need more light. There we go.
Okay, I gave you a chance to reset, hopefully. I like The Expanse. I've watched The Expanse. I'm a little bit unhappy that they're not going to take it to the very end of the book series. They kind of ran out of resources, I think. So some aspects of the story will not be tied in a bow. But them's the breaks. It's very few and far between TV shows that get to run through their entire proper arc.
If I haven't even started it yet, I guess maybe I'll get to it at some point. I'm kind of enjoying, like I said, in retirement, finally getting to read some books that I've wanted to read for many years. You know, it's interesting. You're interested in the history of science. I just reread The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the classic Thomas Kuhn book. You know, if you're... you probably read that at school at some point. Anyway, I read part of it at school in an economics course, of all things, and I always wanted to get it and read through the whole thing, and I was surprised it was actually available on Audible, and I got it a couple of months ago, and